Bring It On is a public affairs program exploring the people, issues, and events affecting the African-American communities in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Bring It On is a forum for the people, by the people, produced by an independent team of volunteers working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana,
and financially supported by listeners like you.
Good evening and welcome to Bring It On. We are a multiple award-winning radio broadcast and just received word as of last week that we won yet another award. Now in our 19th year as Indiana's only weekly community radio show committed to exploring the people, issues, and events impacting the African-American community. Also joining me this evening, we have the lovely Liz Mitchell, our co-anchor, who will be sitting in the seat beside me. We are so fortunate this evening to have Bo Peterson, who is no stranger to Bring It On. She was on probably about 6 months ago and sharing her riveting story, a story of just transparency of life over in South Africa, where she had a family member who passed as white. And she's going to go into that a little bit more detail just to, again, bring us up to speed on that. And we, of course, had a conversation on how it was in America trying to pass as white and such crazy things as the brown bag test. But nevertheless, today she is going to talk about a play that she has brought to the Bloomington community. And the description reads as follows. Discover Bo Peterson's family secrets in a riveting one-woman performance, unveiling her father's hidden life during apartheid. Now, this play delves into identity complexities and the impact of historical injustices. More than a play, it's a powerful exploration of transgenerational trauma and a call to break free from silence. Bo believes in theater's power to heal across generations. So join her on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, at the Hutton Honors Great Hall on the Indiana University campus for an experience of a lifetime that will be this Tuesday, the 16th of April at 7 p.m. on the IU campus in the Great Hall and the Hutton Honors College. And Bo, I'm going to ask you, what is that street address once again?
It is 811 East 7th Street.
811 East 7th Street. Bo has been deputized as a co-anchor here on Bring It On. The name of her one-woman play is Pieces of Me, and it is a catalyst for change. You will come out transformed. An ode to resilience and a beacon of hope for a South African grappling with a tumultuous history as well as the country itself. And don't miss out on this opportunity. Again, it's going to be Tuesday, the 16th of April at 7 p.m. on the IU campus. Now, we're going to jump right in on this conversation with Ms. Peterson. Bo, it's great to see you again.
Thank you.
And Liz first alerted me of this phenomenal play that was coming to town. And I think the last time we talked, we were begging you to try to make plans to bring it to this community because your story is a story that needs to be told. And in a nutshell, please bring our listeners up to speed on what your story consists of.
Okay, so in a nutshell, I up until I was 19, I was brought up to believe I was living in a white family, and then I discovered that my father was passing, and since then I have met my other side of the family. Unfortunately, my father was unable to really talk about it. So there are lots of parts of his story that we don't know, but I was very fortunate to meet one of his sisters who didn't pass and spent a lot of time with her. And so got a lot of information about my grandmother and my other aunts and my uncle. I met my uncle. And so I suppose, in essence, it's about families living with secrets. And in particular, obviously, I grew up in an apartheid South Africa, deeply segregated by law. So lots of law, rules and regulations, and a lot of punishment and terrible punishment. Mm-hmm. And as you talk about the brown bag, in South Africa, we had the pencil test. And the pencil test was where people would put a pencil into your hair, and if it fell out, you were considered white, and if it got didn't move, you were considered black. And in South Africa, under apartheid, you were officially classified. And that was often done by the people you lived with. And so there was a sort of a gray area where people could be, if they were light-skinned enough, and they spent a lot of time with other very light-skinned people, they might be considered white. So, yeah, it was a brutal history. And, you know, the thing is, though, very often South Africa people believe that this only happened in 1948 when the nationalists came into power, but the British really brought the system to South Africa. It just wasn't put into law. Well, there were some laws, segregation laws, yeah. So
tell me, is this a rare occurrence, or did this happen more times than people admit?
More times than you can imagine. You know, it was people trying to really survive, or try to do what was they thought was best for their family. So, like, yeah.
How did it advance one's family? I mean, you say they were trying to survive. Did you have more opportunities if you could pass, or explain what that means?
Absolutely. I mean, the architect of apartheid was a man called Dr. Verwoerd. And he had this sort of lie that he told the world, that this was not, that everyone was equal, but we were just separate. That was a complete and absolute lie. First of all, education for white people was free, not for the any of the other categories. People had to pay. Schoolings had all the resources were given. The country was divided into geographical areas, and the best areas were given to whites. A lot of the beaches, I spent most of my adult life living in Cape Town, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And in those days, the most dangerous beaches was allocated for people of color. And the safest, most beautiful beaches were for people who are white people. Yeah. So on every level, you know, the separate, I mean, as I think a lot echoes with the United States during the Jim Crow, there were separate entrances. Jobs were reserved for whites. There was no way that you could, even if you were the most educated person, if you went to a university as a person of color, you had to apply to the government to get a special dispensation to attend that university.
Well, again, we are so glad, Bo, that you joined us. And for our listening audience, we are recording this on Sunday, the 13th. And she has just completed the first of her, of several of her One Woman Act plays. Today's performance was at the Monroe County Museum. So Liz is going to talk to you, no doubt, about just how you're feeling now in the afterglow of your performance, the thoughts that were going through your mind, and how you felt the audience was receiving you, your story, and just how impactful. We know it was impactful, but and Liz knows it was impactful, but did you accomplish what you set out to do? So I'll turn this over to Liz.
Well, Bo, my question is, and I thought of it at the Q&A, and then it just flew the coop. Here in America, our population is low. Is I think it's about 4 or 5%. Of Black people in about 4 or 5%.
I would dare think, because the census, of course, is the most accurate resource we have, right? I'd say we're about 7 to 8% in America.
Okay.
Now, in
So,
Monroe County in Indiana, we're probably hovering about 5, maybe 6% African American.
even with that low percentage, Bo, there were times we fought back and said, oh, no. Question is, in Africa, it's the opposite. You have more Black people. They say, hey, we're not, this is our country. You come here, you got to go. We're not, and just rebel and fight. Or maybe that happened, and here in America, we didn't know about it. So, did it happen that they said, no? We're going to put the white people out.
I see the similarities in some way between your Native Americans and when the white settlers came to the United States. And I think generally, so with South Africa, yes, I mean it was 80% Black South Africans and 20% settlers who came to the country. I think, initially people, I can't generalize, but there is this philosophy of Ubuntu, which means we are all one. And I think that was the sort of sense initially when the settlers came. Well, I mean, it was I think, a rude awakening. And they came with such kind of, well, they came with guns, and the Bible. And I think it took a long time for people to, but there were always people who were questioning it, but they were often quelled because they didn't have access to guns. And things started from since the settlers came, and then obviously was culminated with the ANC taking over in and becoming the official government in 1994.
And this evening, when I started the Q&A, because I thought about it, I even thought, well, should I or shouldn't I? But Clarence, I asked the audience to look at one another. We turned the lights on, and I said, please look at each other. Look around the room. Who's really Black? Who's really white? And that's what we go through every day. We look at people, go, I wonder what they are. If you see someone with an olive-colored skin and maybe really tight, curly hair, as Americans, it's kind of ingrained in us. We're looking at people going, wonder what they are. That kind of thing. And so I'm just assuming, Bo, that people do that in Africa, in South Africa too, right?
All the time. I think people will qualify when they're telling you a story. They will always qualify, oh, it was a white person, or not. I wonder if they often will say white. They might say the person was Black or something like that. We were officially classified, and there were three main groups, which was white, and then there was a term Bantu or Black, and then there's this interesting term which I know has connotations in the United States, colored. And colored referred to mixed race, but it was a specific category.
Now, you met first time this evening, and you know that he's very fair. Black people and white people, and we do a lot of traveling. I watched people looking at him. We were in Great Britain, and a man came up to him, an elderly white man, said, I've been looking at you and I can't figure out what you are. What are you?
Oh my God.
Did Jim give him the standard Jim response, or was he cordial?
Fascinating stare. And he doesn't, he's been asked that so much.
Wow.
Just stares and never says a word. And other people will walk by, but older white men, I can see the wheels turning, and I think that they're thinking, boy, I've asked a question, and you better answer. And he never does. He just stares. Black people that have asked him that, and I've asked, well, why do you want to know? Oh, I gotta know.
Well, I must tell you, when I met your husband, he actually looks a lot like my older brother.
Oh, see. Yeah. New Orleans last weekend, Bo, some young girl that was a waitress at our table, she said, you look just like my dad. And you act like him. Are you Creole? Are you this? Are you that? And his DNA is really interesting. So I just think of it, especially since we both have done the DNA test. I don't know if you've done it, Bo.
Yes, I have.
We're all kin to one another.
Of course.
My family is your family. We have the same heritage, just background. So
Yeah, it is, for me, it's the biggest waste of energy and it's not only energy. I mean, it's tragedy. I mean, people's lives have been curtailed. I mean, here in the United States, you know, to be able to walk freely and not fear is not an experience that I think, and I speak this as a foreigner, but what I've observed as an African American, it feels like one cannot walk freely and be free in this country and not worry somewhere. If you're a young man or and we are all mixed. We are mixed. We've been traveling. We've been traveling to each other's countries for a long, long time.
Yes. One question. I like one question or follow up, and then I'll let Clarence take over. Looking back at what you know about your father and thinking about his actions and thinking about maybe certain moments that you have witnessed, would you think there was fear at times with him, number one? And number two, do you think he was happy?
You know, I think because he was so close to his mother, I think there was a huge sadness in him, which I think we all felt. And it was because he had made a choice to give us the best life that we could have, and we did. We had an incredibly privileged life. But at the same time, because he had made this decision, it meant that we were cut off from our family. So, you know, for me, it's this thing of belonging. You know, where does one belong? And I think I've always been attracted to people who have a real sense of belonging, of being able to stand up and say, you know, clearly indicate this, these are the people, these are my people. And there was obviously fear. I mean, my father never slept properly. He would sleep, you know, a few hours and then wake up. And I'm convinced that was somewhere there was fear of being exposed. So we were always separate. We lived outside the town. He never had close friends. But he kept in touch with his family without us knowing, which I also, you know, understand. And I just wish he could have shared us all of us together. Yeah.
You know, as I listen to your responses, and you're bringing up all types of new topics to talk about. But for those who've just joined us, we are talking with Miss Bo Peterson, who is in a one-woman play, a one-woman performance, in the project entitled "Pieces of Me," and we have talked about this particular project in times past, but she has brought it to Monroe County, and we're so grateful. And today, this Sunday, when this recording is taking place, she performed at the Monroe County Museum. Now, this Tuesday, and it's not too late to make plans to go to the Great Hall at the Hutton Honors College, Tuesday, April 16th, and it begins at 7 o'clock p.m. You must come and experience Pieces of Me. Now, having said that, Bo, you've raised a lot of points. You mentioned the 80-20 dynamic over in South Africa, and Liz and I both, even growing up over here, we were always just baffled at how 80% of the population could allow 20% to suppress them and do the ultimate and just mind manipulation. To the extent where, as you regard it, as you remarked, here in America, as a black, say a black male walking the street feeling free and unprofiled, unobserved, blending in. And a lot of friends that have gone to Africa to visit remark that when they get off that plane, it's this reverse unique feeling they get, like, wow, I'm amongst the majority. And it's, and some people, it's hard for them to process. They need a half a day to process that. But nevertheless, the 80-20, and how did they successfully mentally suppress individuals to the point where they suppress the vote over there?
Well, you know, the legislation was so brutal. And they managed to, the truth be told, 1913, the British basically took most of the land. They passed an act called the Lands Act, and they took almost 80% of the land and gave it to white people, and then gave 20% of the land to black people. And it was done, through economically keeping people out of possessions, and it just went on and on. And the regime was brutal, tanks and guns, and people were listened to. So, it was a proper fascist regime, and you don't need to do a lot, but you can make people nervous and scared. You want to survive, and if you also then kept out of an economic situation and you're living in poverty, basically all you're doing, all your energy is going to making sure that you and your family have food to eat. You don't really have time to think of starting a revolution. So there are a lot of factors that go into how it lasted for as long as it did.
And there were a lot of individuals who wanted so much to make a change. You mentioned the ANC coming into power. Have you ever had the chance to meet Nelson Mandela?
I was very fortunate. Yes, I did. I met him twice, but very briefly. My husband was more fortunate than me. He spent quite a bit of time with him. Yeah. And he was truly an extraordinary individual.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And Stephen Biko, and of course Bishop Desmond Tutu, and others who were on the front lines, just in the trenches, in the trenches.
We will now take this opportunity to listen to a speech by Nelson Mandela. On February 11, 1990, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. Upon his release, he made a powerful speech calling for the end of apartheid in South Africa. We will listen to this speech now.
Today, my return to Soweto fills my heart with joy. At the same time, I also return with a deep sadness, with a deep sense of sadness. Sadness to learn that you are still suffering under an inhuman system. The housing shortage, the school crisis, unemployment, and the crime rate still remain. The crisis in education that exists in South Africa demands special attention. The education crisis in black schools is a political crisis. It arises out of the fact that our people have no vote and therefore cannot make the government of the day responsive to their needs. Apartheid education is inferior and a crime against humanity. Education is an area that needs attention, that needs the attention of all our people, students, parents, teachers, workers, and all other organized sectors of our community. Let us build disciplined structures, SRCs, a United National Teachers Organization, parent structures, and parent-teacher-student association, and the National Education Crisis Committee. It has been the policy of the ANC that though the school and the entire education system is a site of struggle, the actual process of learning must take place in the schools. I want to add my voice, therefore, to the call made at the beginning of the year that all students must return to school and learn. We must continue our struggle for people's education within the school system and utilize its resources to achieve our goals. I call on the government to build more schools, to train and employ more teachers, and to abandon its policy of forcing our children out of the school system by use of various measures, such as the age restrictions and their refusal to admit to those who failed their classes. We have consistently called for a unitary non-racial education system that develops the potential of all our youth. As I said, when I stood on the dock at the Rivonia trial 27 years ago, and as I said on the day of my release in Cape Town, the ANC will pursue the armed struggle against the government as long as the violence of apartheid continues. A new South Africa has to eliminate the racial hatred and suspicion caused by apartheid and offer guarantees to all its citizens of peace, security,
and prosperity. We call on those who out of ignorance have collaborated with apartheid in the past to join our liberation struggle. No man or woman who has abandoned apartheid will be excluded from our movement towards a non-racial, united, and democratic South Africa, based on one person, one vote, on a common voter's roll. Our primary task remains to unite our people across the length and breadth of our country. Our democratic organizations must be consolidated in all our sectors. Democratic political practice and accountable leadership must be strengthened on all fronts. Our struggle against apartheid, though seemingly uncertain, must be intensified on all fronts. Let each one of you and all of our people give the enemies of peace and liberty no space to take us back to the dark hell of apartheid. It is only disciplined mass action that assures us of the victory we seek. Go back to your schools, factories, mines, and communities. Build on the massive energies that recent events in our country have unleashed by strengthening disciplined mass organizations. We are going forward. The march towards freedom and justice is irreversible. I have spoken about freedom in my lifetime. Your struggle, your commitment, and your discipline has released me to stand before you today. These basic principles will propel us to a free, non-racial, democratic, united South Africa that we have struggled and died for.
We will now return to Bring It On.
You mentioned something earlier about, yes, I took a DNA test, and I wanted to hear the results. and I still, if you're willing to share, I still want to hear these results. What are the percentages? Where are you from?
So I'm from Africa.
Okay.
I mean, from my mother's side, obviously, my mother's lineage is very Britain and Scotland and Ireland. But, you know, and things have become more sophisticated because the first time I took my DNA test was quite a long time ago. And they keep making it more specific.
That's right.
So my father's ancestry is the indigenous people from South Africa who are called the Khoikhoi of the Sand. Some people might know them as Bushmen. They were hunter-gatherers. Those are like the original people, and then the So they also African, and then the Nguni speaking people, so the Xhosa, which was part of Mandela's tribe, they moved from Central and East Africa down to South Africa to farm with their cattle. But I'm talking like thousands of years ago. I've also got ancestry from there. Then my father's on his matrilineal, because my sister and I have been doing quite a lot of archival research. My father's matrilineal ancestors were enslaved women. And we're not sure. We kind of think possibly Asia, Southeast Asia. But enslaved people were brought from Angola and Madagascar, and Malaysia and Indonesia. So, and then Dutch. Because enslaved women were, well, Dutch settlers were entitled to marry enslaved women and indigenous women if they became Christians, if they were baptized, they were renamed. There were very few European women in the Cape at the time the Dutch settlers were there. When the British took over, when they colonized after the Dutch, they brought families. So they brought, so my, like my parents, my mother's ancestors that arrived in 1820, they came already as family units. Yeah.
And two more questions, and I'm going to throw this back Liz's way. You just said something in your response that just made me sit back and like, oh yeah, that's right. You said thousands of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here in America, we're barely over 200 years.
But you know, Clarence, the truth is we all come from the same ancestors. Mm-hmm. We all come from Africa. That's where our human species originated from. And then we went afar, as we, as I think as a species, we enjoy traveling. And then we adapted to our climate. So some of us didn't need as much melanin as our fellow humans needed. So, yeah, I mean, I date. The research I've done is that I'm talking 130,000 years ago, through the first humans sort of recorded in Southern Africa. And on the Xhosa part of the Nguni speaking, that's 4,000 years ago. So, I mean,
and my final follow-up is, I want to segue now into this one woman production. You have a goal, of course, to not only share your riveting story, but to educate, challenge, and wake up people in the audience. You've just performed it now for the first time today. Tell us as you sort of deprocess this day, and you know, it's been a full day for you. Tell us what's going through your mind right now.
You know, I talked to my father before I start my performance, and I talked to him afterwards. So my father's no longer on this mortal coil. He died in 2009, and I had a very special relationship with my father. There's still a part of me that worries that this is not my secret to tell. He kept it a secret for a big part of his life. It would have had dire consequences for him had he been uncovered. You know, he would have gone to jail. My parents' marriage would have been annulled. We would have been removed and made wards of the states, of the state. So I have a bit of flight and flight mode, not so much fight. It has got better every time I've done it, because I do this in honor of both my parents because I think my mother was an extraordinary woman in that she knew my father, what my father's background was, but it meant nothing to her. She adored my father. And so, yeah, so it's a very emotional journey for me, but it is healing as well. Yeah.
How does it open up if you can go through the different either acts or outline for us the performance?
I suppose in essence, you know, I'm an actor by profession and I never understood why I wanted, and it wasn't even that I wanted to be an actor, I needed to be an actor. And I didn't understand that quite until really very recently, 2022, I understood that in fact my father was a consummate actor and that he had kept us safe by assuming a persona. And so I think the play is embedded in my understanding why I needed to become an actor. And then you, within the play, you meet my grandmother. My father was her blue-eyed boy. She had 8 children. You meet my one aunt who passed as white, who wanted nothing to do with the family, cut off all ties with the family, refuses to give us any information about the family. And then you meet my wonderful aunt, Sarah, who was salt of the earth, but, you know, hurt. And all she wanted to do was see my father, who was a favorite brother. So one sees the damage that a system that is unfair and invented, often based on color of skin. And as I've said here, you know, we all have the same common ancestor. So hopefully people think maybe a bit about it when they leave.
Is this a one act or two act performance?
It's just one act. It's an hour long.
Hour long. Okay.
Yeah.
And it starts with you as a little girl, or you mature as a woman, or?
It's me, is me. And then,
Okay.
You go. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. One thing that you brought up when you said, when we talked about how does 80% of the population let 20% run things? And you talked a little bit about Native Americans here.
Yeah.
That made me think of Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. New Zealand.
India. You could just go on and on, and you think
South America.
Yeah. Just traveling and taking over.
Yeah.
Places. So I kind of get what you said, especially if people think, okay, you're coming to visit. We welcome you with welcome arms, and we're forgiving people. It seems like Indigenous people are loving people and welcoming, and we forgive you and that kind of thing. And you think, boy, if it wasn't for that, things wouldn't have happened like they did.
Yep.
They could have immediately, as soon as the white settler set, they could have killed them.
Yep.
Done with it. But they were, had their arms open, thinking, like you said, that we're all one. And you also said that the human, we started in Africa.
Yeah.
And you did the DNA, I did the DNA, and I'm very interested in that, Bo. And I found out that a group went around the world and tested. So it's a proven fact that every person on this earth has the DNA of a Black female.
Yeah.
Deny it, but DNA don't lie.
Yeah.
I find all of that so interesting. And then the fact that we fight and kill each other, and we're still doing it. It's almost like, boy, are humans not very bright? Or what's the problem?
We have serious flaws. We don't get it.
So that's why I think your play for me touched home. Like I said today, I see some of my family in that. Husband, there were people there. And I think most white people in America do not realize that who you call African Americans have very little African blood.
Yeah.
I mean, your DNA, we're mostly European with a little bit of African blood. But someone decided that one drop rule.
They got to put
you in this slot. So the one drop rule here is not necessarily the one drop rule there, is it?
No. That's not. Yeah. And it's now past in a way. So yeah, I mean, the so-called white population in South Africa, especially from the Dutch settlers, and these were the people who ruled the country from 1948. I mean, there's absolutely
you were going to have that one drop rule. And I thought it was strange in Ghana, which, and even Clarence just mentioned that. I've been to Ghana before. I like traveling, and I don't like doing repeats, but I love Ghana, Africa. I like being in Africa. So that I'm going back this July. And the feeling of being there for
breathing me, out.
I could breathe.
Yeah.
And I could walk around. I saw all these beautiful black people, and I'm thinking, this is great. And so they said, well, come move here. And I go, well, I'm old. I got to have good health care.
So I always think, I don't know if you know the Nigerian author Chimamanda Adichie. She said, you know, the first time she realized she was black was when she came to the United States. Mm. So she's from Nigeria. And yeah. I mean, South Africa is slightly different to Ghana, I can say. But if you, depending where in South Africa, if you go now to South Africa to the more northern parts, you would have that same experience. If you came to Cape Town, generally, things are much more open, but there are still some moments when people might be behavior would be very similar. Yeah,
we have a few more minutes in this interview, and there's one thing that I want to ask. You've now visited America. I mean, you're well entrenched in our culture here, and as you sort of witness, or where are you witnessing, what's your observation of the political climate here? Are we doing this big reversal? Or are we, like South Africa, are we evolving into this sort of very inclusive society? Or what's your take on American political dynamics?
I'm
I mean, it's 2024. I have to ask this question.
Well, I'm laughing because I'm like that already today. So
I think I'm terrified. Having lived through a fascist regime, there are so many red flags that are flying fast and furious here. You know, I'm worried about November already, and I think, you know, when people are used to a level of good democracy, I think They don't understand what they have to lose. I think I was, you know, South Africa, the understanding of the United States, I think has shifted quite a lot, and I think shifted quite dramatically after 2017 when you had a new president. I think the rest of the world stopped looking at America and thinking, wow, that's an aspirational country. And I think I fear for this country, quite frankly. And it's difficult. I mean, I see racism latent and on the streets. We left South Africa. My husband was attacked in South Africa. But the little town that I live in, South Bend, Indiana, you know, there's often a fatal gun shooting almost every second day. And it's predominantly African Americans who are dying. I think there's a lot of work. And the thing is that Americans have all, you've got so much in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, the joke when people say we're going to stop affirmative action, I mean, the whites were the first people to be the recipients of affirmative action when they came to this country. This country was not theirs. It belonged to other people. And it's so, for me, I find it surprising that they feel, having had been recipients of affirmative action, being given all the privileges they were at the expense of the indigenous people of the United States, and then enslaved people. I mean, yeah, so.
Yeah, it's complicated, isn't it?
Very complicated. All I'm saying is go and vote. Yeah. You've got to vote. Use your vote. Don't stay at home and don't vote.
Well, I thank you for being open and candid and transparent, just as you are in front of an audience this week and describing pieces of me. Now, is there an accompanying book on your life?
No, my sister and I are busy writing.
Okay.
Busy writing.
Will you come back and talk to us again after the book is complete?
I'll bring my sister with me.
Excellent. Excellent.
Is she here in America?
She is. She works for the United Nations. So she's in New York.
Okay. So she's very busy right now talking to people from Israel and people from Iran. One last thing. What have we not talked about that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
You know, having a democracy is so precious. And all I want to say to people is, first of all, don't just accept things. You know, you have structures that you can use. Mm-hmm. And vote. I mean, it's such a, you know, I mean, in 1994, there were people who had lived their whole lives who had never voted. It's such a privilege, and there's so many places in this world that don't have this opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I want to say to Americans, get out there and vote.
All right. Yeah, right. Thank you so much, Bo.
And yes, yeah. I echo that. We just want to thank Bo Peterson, who is doing a one-woman performance. This week, today, April 13th, she performed at the Monroe County Museum her project entitled Pieces of Me. And it's a very riveting portrayal of her life, with her father as the focus and his efforts successfully to pass, meaning to pass as a white individual in South Africa. If you did not catch that performance today, you can still get out this Tuesday, the 16th of April at 7 p.m. on the IU campus in the Hutton Honors Great Hall on the IU campus. And I'm going to turn to our deputized co-anchor, Bo Peterson, to give us that address one more time.
So it's 811 East. Let me see. Hang on. 811 East 7th Street.
811 East 7th Street. Now, is there a cost involved with this performance?
No, it's free.
It's free.
Yeah.
And just now, thousands of people sat up straight in their chairs. They heard that word. Free. And it just resonated with them. Well, we thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you again. And this will not be the last time. Welcome to the Monroe County and Bloomington area, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Bring It On has an open submission policy, so if you have an idea for this program, let's hear it. Send an email to our volunteer staff. We want to make sure we share everything and anything affecting the African American community with our listening audience in Bloomington and beyond. The email address, once again, is bringiton@wfhb.org. And our show's executive producer is yours truly, Clarence Boone, and our assistant producer is the one and only Liz Mitchell. Our consultant and WFHB News Department Director is Cade Young. Our program engineer is Chantal LaFontaine, and our original theme music was created by Jamil Effiam with additional background tracks by David Baker. And for WFHB, I'm Clarence Boone. And for my guest co-anchor, Liz Mitchell, be sure to tune in next Monday at 6 p.m. for another edition of Bring It On, right here on your community radio station, WFHB.
You've been listening to Bring It On, a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Bring It On is your forum for open dialogue on the people, issues, and events affecting the African-American community in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas directly to the Bring It On staff. The email address is bringit@wfhb.org.
That's bringit@wfhb.org.